You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, suicide and opioid drugs are starting to bring life expectancy down in the United States, according to the CDC. A Wisconsin public health expert looks at the news and tells us what could be done to turn things around. First, it's time for a weekly review of state news. The chancellor of UW-La Crosse continues to face criticism for his decision to bring an adult film star to speak on campus. Governor-elect Tony Evers is talking more about his health care plans for the next budget, and Eau Claire is drastically reducing the penalty for marijuana possession in the city. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thank you.
Well, let's start with this letter now from UW System President Ray Cross reprimanding UW-La Crosse Chancellor Joe Gao for having former adult film actress Nina Hartley give a speech on campus. First, give us the background on this appearance.
Sure. Well, so this was part of UW-La Crosse's Free Speech Week. They invited different speakers, and I think go give a little context to that. Just last year, the UW System Regents passed this new free speech policy for the UW as a whole, all about how important it is for UW campuses to foster different viewpoints and free exchange of ideas and so on. This was pretty clearly in response to complaints among conservatives that their viewpoints were not welcome on campus. It's kind of a national debate, and it was in Wisconsin too. So you get this new official university policy. Free speech is good, and in response to that, UW-La Crosse creates this campus free speech week with different speakers. And one of these speakers that they invited was Nina Hartley, who is a writer, a sex educator, like a sexual health advocate, and who also is a porn performer. And she came and gave a speech. It was a talk called Fantasy versus Reality, A Critical View of Adult Media. And by all accounts, this is like a, you know, normal academic, intellectual kind of discussion on maybe an unusual or especially interesting topic. Turns out this is not the free speech that the university regents had in mind. And so the chancellor has been reprimanded by the system president.
Yeah, what kind of things have we been hearing from System President Ray Cross? A UW regent wrote an op-ed about this. So did Nina Hartley herself. Talk about what the back and forth has looked like here.
Right. So Cross's position is that this was poor judgment, and the regents, I mean, it's quite simple. They just object to there being a porn actress on campus. I mean, really, that's what it comes down to. Like I said, there was nothing. The discussion was a discussion. Nothing particularly risque about the talk. It was just the topic was pornography, the content of the talk. There was some controversy, I guess, over about the money itself. Hartley was paid $5,000 speaker fee, and initially Gao paid that out of his discretionary fund as chancellor, which is to say not with taxpayer money, but with essentially student fees. But I mean, it's all sort of the university budget. After the outcry, he paid back that money out of his own pocket. But that's part of it. Cross said that the university is going to open an inquiry into his use of his chancellor's budget for the last few years, so we really don't know what will come out of that. But, this is like they don't like the topic of the speech on Free Speech Week.
All right, we'll watch to see what ends up happening there. Now, Governor-elect Tony Evers made health care funding one of the key parts of his campaign. He's still actively pressing that. Here he is at the 16th Street Community Health Centers in Milwaukee. This is on Wednesday.
Resources are an issue, and it just reinforces with me the need to, as a state, to access the Medicaid expansion money that we haven't had. We just can't afford to have a society where some people get health care and some people don't.
And this goes back. Governor Walker declined to take this extra Medicaid money from the federal government. Democrats in particular have criticized him for doing that. Is Evers saying he wants to try to have the state do that now?
Right. Evers is a strong advocate for taking the federal money that goes with expanded Medicaid. And because this was a defining difference in the campaign, it was one of the major campaign issues in the governor's race. Evers made these remarks this week as he did a public tour of a community health center in Milwaukee, and he said he intends to travel the state next year and sort of make the case for Medicaid expansion. That's a signal that this is like will continue to be a defining difference between the Democratic governor and the Republican legislature.
And that's the big key here. How much authority, how much power would Governor-elect Evers have when he takes office to do something like this, given that Republicans control both chambers of the legislature?
Yeah, well, none. I mean, no direct authority. But the point here is that he sees it as a political winner for himself and for the Democratic Party. Now, just to review, just on the substance of this, I do think like people lose track of this. I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but it's good to understand. As part of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, states were given the option to expand Medicaid. In Wisconsin, the Medicaid program is called Badger Care. The purpose of that is to provide health insurance to people who are poor. And Wisconsin is unusual. Wisconsin is the only state that did not expand Medicaid, but also does not have a coverage gap. Wisconsin's Badger Care program is actually fairly expansive, and it's possible for people to buy into it even above the federal poverty line. Wisconsin got a waiver to allow that. So the actual uninsured rate in Wisconsin is relatively low. Look, it's bad if you're insured. If you're uninsured, these things are complicated. But it's about 5% or so. And most of those who are uninsured are not the very poorest people in Wisconsin. So the real substantive impact here is on the state's budget. Because when it comes to accepting Obamacare's Medicaid expansion, you get a bunch of federal money that Wisconsin has not been accessing. It amounts to about $1 billion total, and it's estimated that it would be $280 million for the state over the next 2 years if they would accept this under Obamacare rather than doing what we do now with Badger Care Plus.
Talking to Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Moving on to another bit of news this week, Rob, the Eau Claire City Council reduced the fine for possessing certain amounts of marijuana. They reduced it down to a dollar plus court fees. Could you tell us about the change and why they did that?
$1. Yeah, you pay. You know, it sounds like according to the reporting, the total amount you'll pay after court fees would be something like $138. But of course, the fine had been as much as $500 in Eau Claire. So that is a large reduction. So this is for first time offenders. It's not full decriminalization, and of course, Eau Claire is just one city. But this is also a trend, and it will be interesting to see whether other Wisconsin cities move in this direction as well. Because it just reduces the burden on people who are arrested for marijuana possession, at least first-time offenders. But it also sends a signal to that city's police department about what the priorities are going to be, and that was like explicitly the goal of some of the policymakers in Eau Claire to just say, just not prioritize this particular crime.
And I believe the city council members there cited a recent advisory referendum in Eau Claire, and we've seen these in cities and counties around the state, whether on recreational or just medicinal marijuana. There's been a lot of support, evidently, for some form of decriminalization of marijuana around Wisconsin, right?
Right. So there were referendums all across the state, and they all passed. They were, they varied, right? Some were favoring medicinal marijuana. Some had other types of wording. But like they're advisory. They don't have the force of law anywhere. But they all passed, and most passed by like a large margin. And that is an indication. I mean, things can change. These are just advisory referendums, and there can always be a political backlash, I suppose, but it is an indication, I think, of where the Wisconsin electorate stands, is overall, it's going to be politically popular to make moves like this in Eau Claire and potentially elsewhere.
All right. We'll check in again with you next week, Rob. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That's Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He was with us for a weekly look back at news stories from around the state. Life expectancy kept going up and up in the United States for years, decades. But in the last few years, it's been slipping downward for the first time basically since World War I and the global influenza epidemic 100 years ago. Why? Rising deaths from powerful opioids and a growing number of suicides may be a big part of the story. Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor and associate dean in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
Well, we've got new numbers out this week from the CDC showing this decline, and it's suggesting this isn't just a one-year blip. It's not a huge drop-off, but there is an ongoing issue here, right?
It is a trend now. It's not just one year of decline, but we've had 2 years in a row where life expectancy has decreased. I think if you actually look at the number, you're surprised by the small rate of decline. It went from 78.7 years to 78.6 years, so just one-tenth of a year. But this number is based on millions of deaths, and so changing even a tenth of a year is a significant change, and it means that there are things going on in some of the leading causes of death at younger ages that we need to keep track of.
Now, life expectancy, it's kind of a blunt measure with lots of moving parts underneath it. But does this give us a pretty good indication of improving health over decades and decades and now backsliding a little bit?
Well, I think it is a very blunt measure. It's basically it's a prediction of how long a baby born today is expected to live. And right now, it's about 78 to 79 years of age. But it's made up of death rates by all the subgroups, by different age groups, by men and women, by people of different races, and different communities. So it's a very blunt instrument, but it's used internationally, and as such, it's a good way to sort of ask the question, how are we doing overall? Are we achieving the goal of longer and healthier lives for all? And that the answer would be no. We're moving in the opposite direction of shorter lives, and then you have to really dig deeper to look at the underlying reasons for this change.
And the CDC report looks at, as you mentioned, causes of death for people not at the very oldest years, but in younger life or middle age. And the big story here seems to be opioids and suicide. Before we separate those, are there common themes you see as we look at those two causes of death?
Well, there are, and in fact, the term deaths of despair has been used. We produced a paper last year that was entitled The Epidemic of Despair in America, because the leading causes of the decrease in life expectancy, the death rates that are climbing, are related to self-destructive behaviors, things like suicide, drug overdose, liver disease due to alcohol abuse, and obesity is underlying many of the cardiovascular diseases that we haven't seen as much decline as we'd like.
Why, as a society, would we be seeing these diseases of despair on the rise?
Well, that's a easy question without a simple answer. People have pointed towards challenging economic times for people, particularly following the Great Recession, where opportunities are not as good as they might have been 10 or 20 years ago. We're looking particularly at availability of opioids and through prescriptions, but also availability on the street. And really, suicide and opioid overdose and drug overdose are really symptoms of this underlying problem. There are reasons why people seek pain relief, why people eventually commit suicide. And our system really hasn't been addressing those underlying root causes. We aren't as good as we need to be at identifying depression and treating it appropriately, particularly in populations that are hard to reach.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at new numbers from the CDC backing up what they've been saying over the last couple of years. Small but significant declines in life expectancy in the United States after years and years of that going up. Opioids and suicide, two big parts of the story. And it looks like looking at the causes of death related to opioids, a lot of the story, Patrick, is related in large part to things like fentanyl and its close relatives, legal and illegal. These more powerful opioids seem to be linked to a lot of the increase in death. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Early on, we were concerned about the over-prescription of opioids, for example, following a dental procedure or for back pain. But what we've discovered is that the reason for the dramatic increase in deaths are the synthetic opioids. And these are very dangerous. They're not predictable. And people who overdose and die as a result, you know, there are often no suicide notes left. People wonder whether this was a self-destructive behavior that was, in effect, a suicide. But we think not. We think that these are people who are suffering, who are using synthetic opioids. Sometimes they don't even know that it's what's in the opioid that they're using. So it's a very dangerous drug. It can be lead to death suddenly. And again, people are using it for pain control and really solving some issues in their life, not realizing the potential fatality or lethality of the drug.
Let me lay out a scenario and see if this is if you think this is a common thing. Somebody maybe gets a milder opioid like Vicodin for, back pain. They got it work, something like that. They take it for a while. The supply dries up. They get a hold of something like this fentanyl on the street from a friend, wherever. Pill, maybe it's roughly the same size. They're used to that Vicodin dose, and now they're taking something stronger, and they have no idea how much stronger that is.
Absolutely. That's a scenario that plays over and over again. The challenge is that as we attempt to look at this epidemic and to try and address it in many fronts, providers have definitely begun to scrutinize the use of prescriptions for routine pain. I think anybody listening to this radio show may have had an experience where you've gone in the past and you might have gotten a prescription, and now those aren't given routinely. Or, you know, if people have visited the emergency room with significant pain and they go home with Tylenol. Those are appropriate prescriptions now, and that's a change. But for people who are addicted, that change in prescribing patterns can lead to people seeking other forms of pain relief, and synthetic opioids are clearly more dangerous and a big risk factor in the increasing rates of overdose deaths.
A lot more to be said about opioids, but I do want to look at the suicide rate. Now, The Economist just had this global look at suicide rates around the world, those rates going down in country after country, plummeting in a place like Russia where they'd been very high, going up gradually here in the United States recently. Why are we going up as most of the rest of the world is going down when it comes to suicide?
Well, again, suicide is a complex public health problem. Since 1999, our suicide rates have gone up by a third. So it is another major public health crisis. And there are the root causes of suicide, and then there's the mechanism of suicide. And you really need both. And in this country, we have a mental health care system that really isn't as effective as it could be. We don't have public providers that reach people who are particularly at need. And so oftentimes, suicide is a last resort for somebody seeking mental health services. And then the lethal means. Firearms are readily available, and it's a lethal means. More people die in this state and in this country from gunshot wounds to themselves than die from murders and homicides. So having a mental health crisis along with availability of a lethal means is really a crisis, and we have to have a comprehensive approach. We have to better understand how to reach people who might have depression, and also how to address reducing access to lethal means, particularly people who are at risk.
I've talked to you about these issues before, and you and a lot of your colleagues in the public health community have been sounding the alarm about these diseases of despair for a while, I think before they were in the public eye. Do you see actual effective action being taken now by policymakers, people in the medical professions and beyond?
I think there's still a disconnect. The social media tag, "This is our lane," is a good example where the healthcare providers are talking about firearm injuries, suicide being one important cause. I think you're going to see more and more healthcare systems and healthcare providers reaching outside of the clinic to try and work with community partners to find solutions and common ground. And I think it is a challenge because we tend to work pretty well in silos, and health systems take care of people who are really sick. But it's the people who are still struggling with a job, with depression, and at risk of substance abuse and at risk of committing suicide, that those services are not well connected, and we just need to do a better job working in communities to do that.
We'll leave it there for now. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
It's Dr. Patrick Remington, professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. A proposed transmission line in western Wisconsin is in the works and facing some local pushback. The project is known as the Cardinal Hickory Creek Transmission Line. If it's approved, it would start to the west of Madison and run through Dane, Iowa, Grant, and Lafayette counties, ending up in Dubuque County, Iowa. We'll hear the case for and against this project, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live in the area that this planned transmission line would go through, is this something you're paying attention to? What do you think of it? Are you concerned about how it affects the environment, the scenery in your area, or do you think it's needed for reliable power in your part of the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. The project is being proposed by American Transmission Company, ITC Transmission, and Dairyland Power. A note to listeners, American Transmission Company is a WPR underwriter. Kaya Freeman is a communications representative with American Transmission Company. Kaya, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We'll talk about the need for this line. From your perspective, why is this a needed project?
Sure. The Cardinal Hickory Creek project is a 345,000-volt project that has been proposed starting back in actually 2011. It was proposed and approved as a slate of 17 multi-value projects throughout the upper Midwest that were planned and designed to provide a number of benefits. The first is reliable electricity. The second is access to lower cost power. And the third is access to renewable energy.
Yeah, let's talk about those each in turn. First, as far as costs, it'll cost something to build these. Are ratepayers going to see rates go up related to the construction of a line like this?
This is a unique project in how the cost is laid out. This is a cost-shared project. The cost of it is shared throughout the upper Midwest. And while the cost of construction is estimated to be about $500 million, Wisconsin ratepayers are expected to pay about $66 million. While there is a cost involved with construction, there are also economic benefits. There have been numerous cost-benefit studies done starting back in 2011. At the regional level, MISO, which is the grid operator that oversees the system throughout the upper Midwest, looked at this project along with others and did an analysis of the cost and benefits, showing that this project and the others would provide significant benefit to the entire region. That's why they're cost shared. So they did that in 2011 initially, did it again in 2014, and again in 2017. So every 3 years they review it and look at the cost and benefits for it. Now that our project is before the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin, there has been a specific cost benefit analysis done for Wisconsin ratepayers. So it looks at the amount of money that ratepayers will pay for the project. So that's about $66 million out of the $500 million cost, and the benefits that they will receive. And the projected benefits for Wisconsin ratepayers are up to $350 million.
And talk about energy reliability. Do we have demand going up enough that there's a need for this new transmission capacity?
Well, electric reliability is different than demand. Mm-hmm. This project has numerous drivers, reliability, access to lower cost power, and access to renewable energy. And it's not following demand growth. Demand growth is modest at the state level. I believe it's about 0.5%. And at the national level, I believe it's somewhere in that range as well. So when folks may hear that demand is declining or going down, that's simply not the case. Demand is still growing. It's just at a lower rate than the historically high levels. How this project improves electric reliability? Well, essentially, our transmission lines serve as the interstate highway for power. It allows us to move a lot of power from a lot of different sources very reliably because we have the space to do it. So if you want to, for instance, reliably transport any type of materials on the interstate, you know you can generally do it pretty reliably in a reasonable amount of time without the bottlenecks of the lower roads, highways, and smaller areas. This project similarly would create a connection, an interstate connection between Wisconsin and Iowa, and these larger lines serve the lower voltage lines. So everywhere that you see a line in a community like Madison or any area in southwest Wisconsin or Iowa, that community is served by generally lower voltage transmission lines, maybe a 69,000 volt transmission line, 138,000 volt transmission line. This line is a 345,000 volt transmission line. Those lines are located throughout the state, other states, and the country, of course, and they allow power to be moved very efficiently, and they allow people who need to purchase the power, the utilities, to buy the most cost-effective power and to buy the sources of generation that they wish to purchase. Increasingly, that is renewable energy, and that's evidenced in the changing energy landscape. When you look at it, beyond the reliability that a line like this offers, it also really opens up the marketplace. You see generation retirements coming at historic levels. We have about 10 gigawatts of planned retirement coming.
That means shutting down a coal plant, for
correct,
example.
Correct. And that is significant. 10 gigawatts is about 10 million homes. A line like this allows us to provide access to replacement power. When you take those plants offline, you need to have access to the newer sources of power. And that helps us maintain a reliable system.
Talking to Kaya Freeman from American Transmission Company about a proposed power line across southwestern Wisconsin. To your calls now, we'll go to Ed on the line in Dodgeville. Ed, hi. Ed, are you there? Not hearing Ed. Let's try John with us in Ridgeway. John, hello. John, are you there? Okay. Wonder if we've had a relapse of our phone problems from yesterday. We'll try that again at 800-642-1234. Kaya, a common objection is, hey, this is southwestern Wisconsin.
Hello.
Driftless, a very scenic. This is going to be something that disrupts the scenery and the environment of the area.
We have heard that, and one of the reasons why not only we look to minimize impacts by siding with existing infrastructure, the state also requires it. So how do you minimize new impacts, minimize impacts to different areas? You site infrastructure where it already exists. If people look at the project maps, they will see that our preferred route largely follows existing infrastructure, and there is existing infrastructure in this area in the way of existing transmission lines and an existing four-lane highway. We have heard many comments, and we work as best as possible to try to minimize these impacts because we understand that people do have an interest in these projects and they value their areas. And the best way that we've found we can do this is following existing infrastructure.
Let's try one more time with the caller. John is with us in Ridgeway, we hope. John, hi.
Yep.
There you are.
Thank you.
What do you want to bring up, John?
Oh, a couple things.
You know, they're saying they're allocating the cost to other states in the MISO area, but there were 16 prior projects which all were allocated costs to Wisconsin ratepayers. So why is it fair to say that Wisconsin ratepayers are only responsible for $66 million of a $500 million project that goes only through Wisconsin?
All right, John, I thanks for the call. Kai, I'm not sure what he's getting at.
Yes, I understand the question. What he is asking about is the fact that these projects are cost-shared. There were 17 projects that were cost-shared throughout the entire MISO footprint.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So 17 of them. And when they planned, proposed, and designed these, looking at the numerous benefits they would provide to the region, they allocated that the costs be shared throughout the area. So Wisconsin has paid for 10 to 15% of these other 16 projects. This is the last of those projects. Wisconsin would pay for 10 to 15%. We're estimating that at about $66 million. And to that point, we have invested in the regional grid. And this is the last project. This is the project that completes the entire network and allows us to deliver the significant benefits. So essentially, Wisconsin, for a very small investment, gets all of the benefits of this regional transmission line. Some of those include enabling access for 25 gigawatts of wind power to get on here. This network of 17 projects is planned to do it. It's also planned to lower emissions. It's an important project. That's why they did determine that we should cost share them. And the caller is correct that the costs were shared by Wisconsin as well as the other states for all 17 projects.
And as we wrap up, Kyle, what are the next steps for the project?
Right now, the project is under numerous regulatory reviews. It is being reviewed by the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. It's being reviewed by the Iowa Utilities Board. And there is a NEPA process that's going on as well to review the project. So there are significant reviews going on as far as the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin that may be of most interest because we're on Wisconsin Public Radio, of course. There will be technical hearings, public hearings, lots of opportunities for public input. There were scoping sessions recently, and the commission has a wealth of information on their site. If people want to learn more about this project, if people are hearing things about this project, and if people want to look at the analysis for this project, I advise them to look at that site. They can see all of the information, they can follow the proceedings, and they can definitely review down to a great level of detail all that we have to say about this project and all that others have to say about it.
Kaya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Kaya Freeman, a communications representative from American Transmission Company, with us to talk about the utility's proposed transmission line running from Dubuque County, Iowa to just west of Madison. Coming up, we'll hear from a group that is opposed to the project, and you can still join in with your thoughts and questions about the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about the Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line, a project that would bring power, connect power from Dubuque County, Iowa, through western Wisconsin, a line ending west of Madison. We just heard from one of the companies involved in the project. We hear now from someone opposed to the project, and you can still join in at 800-642-1234, especially if you live in that part of the state. What are your thoughts on this proposed transmission line? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mike Van Sicklen is the board president of the Driftless Area Land Conservancy. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, tell us why you are worried about this project. You don't think it's needed.
Okay. Two points. First, as a president of the Driftless Area Conservancy, it contravenes our core mission of protecting the rural landscape and the people of southwest Wisconsin. Driftless covers a 5-county area, and we place conservation easements on property. And so this line would directly contravene the purpose of our organization and cross and be near many of our conservation easements. Secondly, as an individual, I oppose it because I believe in grassroots democracy, and I believe this is just a pay-to-play opportunity by ATC. I would note that the two counties most most affected. Iowa County and Dane County have intervened in the proceeding against it to represent the interests of their constituents, as well as numerous towns and villages.
And we've heard from the company that, okay, yes, this is a new power line. It's going to follow existing infrastructure, other power lines, highways, so that they're making the case it won't be all that disruptive. What do you say to that?
I disagree, obviously. I note that Vilas Hall here is 7 stories high. These power poles are going to be roughly 17 stories high, crossing a landscape where most buildings are 2 or 3 stories high at most. It's going to be crossing very important view sheds, like in front of Blue Mound State Park, or if it's the alternate route next to Governor Dodge State Park. And it's going to detract from the rural atmosphere of the area. It's going to hurt landowners along that path and deter investment capital, I believe, and businesses and the like.
One of the hopes here is that this could help promote alternative energy, so maybe the cost to the view, the landscape, might be balanced out by the benefits in terms of climate change, say.
And again, I would disagree with that. First, I think the other speaker noted or acknowledged that there's no need for this power in Wisconsin. The former chair of the PSC spoke in this very room last year and noted that Wisconsin has an excess of power. And so there's no need to import power from the West to us. So there's no need for the line to go in. Secondly, Wisconsin has a very reliable grid. It's ranked number 7 in the country, according to U.S. News and World Report. It's an A reliability state. And so, again, the reliability argument they advance, I think, does not make sense. And then as far as the alternative, you know, the green energy argument, we're going to bring in renewable energy from the West, I think that's fallacious as well. First, this would be what's called an open access line. And by law, that means that it carries all types of generated power, including coal, nuclear, gas, as well as wind and solar. The best estimates we've gotten is that the green energy that would be used on this line is a distinct minority of the total power. Conversely, it discourages the investment of renewable energy sources here in Wisconsin. Right now, we have 2 gigantic green energy facilities going in. One just came online, the Quilt Block wind power facility down in the Darlington area. One is in the process of being constructed, which is the Badger Hollow Solar Farm out by Dodgeville. That would be the largest solar farm east of the Mississippi and one of the largest in the United States. Both of those facilities came to Wisconsin irrespective of ATC. They don't need ATC. The solar farm has admitted in writing, given to the Iowa County Board, that they don't have any present plan to use the ATC line. And so by circumventing and discouraging local investment of facilities built by Wisconsin, you know, employees, I think that's counterproductive for our state.
Talking to Mike Van Sicklen, board president of the Driftless Area Land Conservancy. We're talking about this proposed transmission line running through much of southwestern Wisconsin. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Terry is on the line in Milwaukee. Terry, hi.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. I welcome your guest. The Paul Harvey side of the story is always important. My comment had to do with the security aspect of it. Your first guest commented about how with this much larger line with a capacity to carry much more energy, we may not need a lot of these smaller secondary distribution lines. Well, that sounds wonderful, except what if someone from a Homeland Security standpoint takes out one of those towers or lightning strikes or something happens? Instead of 10,000 people being out of energy, now you have 250,000 people out of energy. So I'm just wondering, has someone looked at this from a Homeland Security standpoint and from a practical standpoint in terms of how many people are going to be affected when something bad happens?
Gotcha. Terry, thanks for the call. Is that a part of the story you've been tracking, Mike?
Only in a very special, I guess, segment of that, and that is not the Homeland Security, but out in California, where you had all these recent huge fires, there's been a lot of study of the fact that these large power lines are vulnerable to these fires, and it can create the kind of problem that Terry, our last caller, just mentioned.
Thanks for the call, Terry. We'll go next to John with us in Janesville. John, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
I was wondering the last time that they did that, put in the big power lines that followed 12 and 18, turned down I-90, went past Highway N, I think it is, and turned right there. They took out all the trees and leveled down all the mountains and stuff, all the hills. They took everything out. I stopped and I asked them when they were working on it, because they kept taking out more trees. I said, are you going to replace these trees? And they go, oh, yes, they will all be replaced. That's been years. They've never replaced them.
John, thanks for the call. Any thoughts on, I guess, landscape restoration, tree restoration when these lines go through?
It's pretty difficult to replace the type of landscapes that would be destroyed here. No, they do not reforest it with old growth trees and the like they take down. This would be devastating to the appearance of Southwest Wisconsin.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Go next to Ivy with us in Evansville. Ivy, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My problem with this is whenever you have power lines, you lose energy along the line. And I don't understand why we don't invest in, like, localized energy, like rooftop solar. As long as we're going to invest and pay for all this stuff as taxpayers, why not support that kind of thing where it's right on site and there's no loss to energy and there's no, destruction of the landscape? So that's my question.
Ivy, thanks for the call. I'll throw that to you, Mike. But also a concern is that, okay, if we're relying on local power, a transmission line helps us if it's cloudy in Wisconsin and sunny in Iowa or vice versa. These transmission lines can help these localized power sources back each other up.
When you carry power a long distance, you do lose some of it as it's carried across these lines. And the reason to invest locally in facilities, like you see with Quilt Farm in Darlington and the Badger Hollow out by Dodgeville, is it's local generation. You don't lose that power. You diversify the sources of power. Wind tends to generate more at night than solar, obviously, during the day, and they back each other up. There's no good reason to import power from the far west except the fact that these utilities, who are the shareholders of ATC, have investments out there. ATC does not generate power. It does not sell power. It's a construction company that has a statutory guaranteed rate of return on its investment of 10.2%. This is just a way for them to make a massive profit. These utilities are not making money selling power, so they're trying to make money by building facilities that aren't needed.
We'll leave it there for now. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Mike Van Sicklen, board president of the Driftless Area Land Conservancy, talking about the proposed Cardinal Hickory Creek transmission line. We also heard from a representative from American Transmission Company earlier in the hour. Coming up Monday on Central Time, there have been a lot of developments in the Mueller probe over the last week. We'll sort out the latest news about Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, and Russian business deals. And restaurants are too darn loud for a lot of people anyway. We'll find out why more and more restaurants are pushing the decibel meter into the red and how some diners are pushing back. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time.